The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thanks, Al. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Bible Shots for another week. Great to have you along here as we're thinking about what does it look like to be truly great? And I guess one of the ways that you could figure out the answer to that question, you know, what it looks like to be truly great, is to figure out, well, who are the great ones? Who are the ones that we recognize as great? Kind of work backwards from there. It's the question that the disciples were asking Jesus at the start of the passage, but it's a question we can ask in our context today. So, you know, if you wanted to find out, well, how to be a great Australian, we could look at a list of who some of the great Australians are and work backwards from there. And conveniently enough, we have a list already made. There's a journalist, Billy Rule, who back in 2013 for Australia Day, he wrote an article called The Greatest of All, Our Top 50 Australians. This is from a Perth newspaper, but it was picked up by The Australian for Australia Day celebrations in 2013. And so, for example, one of my favourites, Charles Kingsford Smith, he came in at number 20. So Charles Kingsford Smith, he was a great Australian. He was the first person to complete a trans-Pacific flight, so from America to Australia, back in 1928. Quick poll. Anyone have any ideas about who would have come in at number one? Don Bradman. If you thought Don Bradman, Charmian, you would be wrong. He came in at number two. Even though he was described as the most dominant sportsman the world had ever seen, as you just think it's hard to get much greater than that, he came in at number two. Number one was actually Mr. Banjo Patterson. Andrew Banjo Patterson, the great bush poet. His words were described as funny, clever, inspiring, and loyal, which are also core traits of how Australians like to see ourselves. That was who was identified as the greatest Australian of all time in the article. You may disagree. You're welcome to. It's one of the fun things about top 50 lists. But I think the thing I really wanted to note from the list, and that we even saw from our examples, is that the people on that list, the people we identified as great, they're great because of what they'd done. They're great because of achievement. And I think it's often the same for us in our lives. The way we see greatness, it's often tied to achievement. You know, if it's at work, you know, the cases you've closed, exceeding your targets, the number of digits in your salary, even your job title itself. I think the fact that we can see greatness tied to achievement, it's clear in that question that we often ask and get asked when we first meet someone, you know, what do you do? I don't know, how do you feel when people ask you that question? Is it something you can answer with a bit of pride, or is it something that you sort of, you know, sheepishly kind of, you know, oh, you know, I do this. What sort of a reaction do you get? You know, before I was working for City Bible Forum several years ago now, I used to work in a customer service call centre, and the reactions you got, you know, it was a good job, it paid reasonably well, but the reactions you got when you said, I work at a customer service call centre, very quickly people would lose interest. You weren't someone worth talking to. Which was, of course, better than the reaction I sometimes get when I tell people that I'm a full-time Bible teacher and look like they're screaming with their eyes, thinking, how do I get out of this conversation? But anyway, it's not just our jobs, though. It's not just our jobs that we tie greatness to. We tie greatness to other indicators of achievement. So, you know, what suburb you live in, what car you drive, where your kids go to school. These are all things that sometimes are pointers to whether or not you're great. Again, here in Australia, we don't really like tall poppies, so some of us might not go as far as saying, I want to be great. But being greater than I am now, well, you know, that's okay. But it still leads to the same problem. See, when you live in a culture that's a meritocracy like Australia is, greatness is tied very closely to what you do and what you have. And that leads to a problem that we call status anxiety. You know, we worry about how others perceive us. We want to be seen as great. We want people to respect us. They're a lot nicer when they do. But when it all depends on what we do and what we have, especially when it's relative to others, it's a no-win game. You can never be great enough. You can never have enough. We want to be great, but the path to greatness by achievement, it actually has massive flaws. And so today we're actually going to look at a passage where Jesus answers the question, who is the greatest? Bible Shots have been working our way through the story of Jesus, told by Matthew, one of his followers. And the last 2 weeks we were at a point in the story where we were being asked to think about who Jesus is. And the position put forward was that Jesus was the Christ. So Jesus was God's King over everything and everyone. And so this week, Jesus is getting his followers to think a little bit more about, okay, if that's true, if Jesus is the King, well, what does that mean for how we look at the world, how we view the world? How should his followers think about greatness, and what does it mean? And so those are our two main points in the talk today. First, we're going to talk about Jesus' take on how to be great. And second, we're going to talk about, well, what does that mean? What does it mean for his followers? How to be great, and what does that mean? So first of all, how to be great. Picking up from verse 2 there on the passage that's in front of you. He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And he said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." We are a culture that values children a lot more than the ancient world did. We know they can actually achieve great things. For example, Bishop Curry. He's an 11-year-old from Texas. And just recently, about 6 weeks ago, it was announced that he had invented a device to help prevent infants from dying in hot cars. Kids can achieve great things, we know this, but I don't think that's the sort of child Jesus has in mind. I think this is a bit more like the sort of picture of a child that Jesus is actually describing. You know, there's nothing wrong with this kid. I'm sure he's a lovely kid, but, you know, he's clearly not a great ruler. He's clearly not someone who has great power or influence, and I don't think he's going to become wealthy by finding treasure anywhere he's digging. The point that Jesus is making is that children are dependent. They're dependent on the people who are caring for them, whether it's their parents or babysitters or a childcare worker. They're dependent on them to give them, you know, what they need, whether it's food or clothing or other care. A child is dependent, and all they can do is actually receive what's given to them. And Jesus says to his followers, if you can't get that right, well, you aren't even going to get into his kingdom, let alone be the greatest. But on the other hand, if they do take that position of being like a lowly child, well, then they will be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So somehow, greatness, getting into Jesus' kingdom, heaven, eternal life, it all hinges on becoming like a child, assuming this posture of dependence. Last week we saw that the problem that all people everywhere were facing was that they're guilty before God, and they're headed for his judgment. We also saw that their only hope was that God would show them mercy. The hope that people could be spared from the judgment that they were heading towards, it's grounded in the fact that God offers a gift of forgiveness. But forgiveness also needs to be accepted. And if the disciples can't become like children and accept the gift of forgiveness, they won't be saved. If they keep trying to earn God's favour through what they've achieved, the things that they do and the things they can hold up and say, look at how great I am, they will not be saved. Jesus' followers need to become like children, or to use the language of verse 6, they need to become like one of these little ones, those who believe in me. They need to believe in Jesus and become one of his little ones, dependent on him. They need to accept the gift of mercy that Jesus is offering to those who believe in him. That's the way to enter God's kingdom. That's the way to be truly great, according to Jesus. So it's a fairly straightforward answer to our question. How do you be truly great? Jesus says, become like a child, be dependent. It shifts the focus of where greatness lies. It's not so much about achievement and what you've done. It's actually on relationship, on who you know. Part one, we're looking at how to be truly great, and Jesus says it's not about achievement, it's about relationship. Part two, what does that actually mean? Well, Jesus gives three examples of what it means to be great in God's kingdom. And he starts drawing out some implications for his little ones, those who believe in him. He starts drawing out some implications for what it means, how they should view themselves, as well as other little ones. And so Jesus pushes the thinking, pushes our thinking to see, well, actually, his model of greatness is very, very different from the achievement-based model that we usually see around us. And it has implications for how his followers relate to each other and the way they relate to achievements generally. And I think it actually offers freedom from that status anxiety that we were talking about before that can gnaw away at each of us. Jesus offers a better kind of greatness. So let's have a look at what the greatness Jesus is talking about means. There's three reasons to be one of Jesus' little ones. He says they're his representatives, they're represented, and they're loved. And we'll have a look at each of those in turn. So first, they're representatives. He says that in verse 5, "And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." Jesus identifies with his followers so much that the way others treat them, well, it's actually like they're treating Jesus the same way. It's kind of like his followers become ambassadors, representatives of Jesus wherever they go. The greatest of an ambassador, it's based on who they represent. And it's the same with Jesus' followers. They're representing the king. And being great, we mentioned this before, being great changes how people relate to you. If you've achieved greatness based on your, salary or based on a good job, you'll know that actually it changes how people treat you. But that sort of greatness, it doesn't last though. You can get ousted from your job, you can lose money, the favoured position of even the people you work for can decline. And if your greatness is grounded there, well, it's not certain. But if your greatness is because of your relationship to the king, and if Jesus is the king is a constant thing, well, regardless of how much Jesus' followers have achieved or haven't achieved, Jesus says he identifies with them. So actually, Jesus' followers are to welcome each other. Because Jesus, the king, identifies with them. So firstly, Jesus identifies with his little ones. They are representatives of him. But second, they are represented. Skip down to verse 10 there. Jesus says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven." It sounds a little bit strange to a modern audience, but they have angels. Messengers and agents of God who see God face to face. And I don't want to speculate too much on angels right now. The text doesn't give us too much to go on, but feel free to ask some more questions in question time if you'd like. But it seems to be a picture of God's agents who are looking out for the interests of his little ones. And so Jesus says, don't despise them. As you come to any sort of group, there's always going to be people who are more impressive and less impressive. Given where we are and our demographic at City Bible Forum, there's a pretty high level of impressive in the room. But, if someone was so inclined, they could still come in, they could use a certain metric, and they could still rank everyone in here according to who was most impressive and who was least impressive, who was most worthy of their time and who's not worthy of their time. But Jesus says that's not how his little ones are actually meant to treat each other. That's not the sort of metric they're meant to use, because actually Jesus' little ones will recognize that God has invested heavily in other little ones. He's invested heavenly resources into them and caring for them and protecting for them and looking out for them. So no matter how much or how little Jesus' little ones have achieved, actually, they are great. God has invested great resources into them. Which brings us to the third reason good to be one of Jesus' little ones, and that's because they are loved. God will not let them perish. So there in verse 12, we have this image of a shepherd looking for his sheep. And notice that the shepherd, he cares about every individual in his care. God says he will not let them perish. Which gives you great confidence in in how God sees you, in how valuable you are in his eyes, if you're one of his little ones. Again, it doesn't matter how much you've achieved or how small or broken or unimportant you might seem, the Father will not let you perish. And that runs quite counter to the way, you know, a lot of countries and big corporations run, where you're a number in the system and it's all too easy to fall through the cracks, especially if you're not someone important by the standards of achievement. But God won't let one of his little ones perish. Well, there you have it. There's three reasons, three things it means if you are one of Jesus' little ones, if you are great in Jesus' kingdom. You are representatives, you are represented, and you are loved. But there's one thing I skipped over before. Back in verse 6, Jesus sort of, he interrupted the flow of what we were looking at, these reasons, what it looks like to be great in his kingdom. And it really added a level of seriousness to what Jesus was talking about. I don't know if you noticed when Al read the passage before, but the language Jesus uses to warn his disciples here about how serious this issue he's talking about is. Jesus really doesn't hold back. Did you notice verse 6? He says, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. This stuff isn't optional extras for Jesus' followers. Jesus takes it very seriously. In the context of thinking about greatness, you know, could Jesus be saying, if you're encouraging others to live, to thoughtlessly pursue greatness based on achievement, instead of pointing them to Jesus, or you know, if you're putting hurdles in front of them, expecting to achieve something before they're actually recognized as followers of Jesus, well, you're not doing the best thing by them, and actually you're doing them great harm, because if they're chasing something else, something that's achievement-based to become great, well, they're not acting like a lowly child anymore. They're actually not going to get into the kingdom. And that idea, it's really countercultural, that you might say to someone, you know, maybe this isn't the right time to accept that promotion. Do you really need to be growing your business at this time? What's it going to cost you? Suggesting that maybe this isn't the time to keep moving forward and up and achieving more really isn't the way that our culture operates. But the king identifies with his little ones, so much so that anything that challenges his rule in their lives all is a very serious thing. And so Jesus warns his followers not to cause others to stumble, other little ones to stumble, but he also warns them to look out for themselves. He says in verse 8, if your hand or foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown into eternal fire. And when it comes to sin, Jesus calls his followers to be like Aaron Ralston. You may know the story of Aaron Ralston. While canyoning in Utah a number of years ago, a boulder dislodged, it crushed his right hand against the canyon wall, and he got trapped. He was stuck there for 5 days before he managed to amputate his own arm so that he could actually escape the canyon and live. Jesus calls his little ones, his followers, to have that same attitude to sin in their lives. What things are you chasing in order to be great, in order to be impressive? Because if there's something that you're chasing that's then distracting you from following Jesus, that's actually displaced him from that position of king, well, he says to his followers, cut it out, even if it's something valuable. And it sounds really extreme, but Jesus doesn't want his little ones chasing achievement based on greatness that won't deliver. Well, in today's passage, we've seen what it looks like to be great according to Jesus, and we've seen it's completely different to the way that we usually think of greatness in the world around us. It's not based on achievement, but relationship. And becoming one of Jesus' little ones, it might not look impressive because there's no achievement involved, but it impacts how followers of Jesus actually see themselves and how they relate to each other and how they view the world. It's possible that some people here, if you identify as a follower of Jesus, that you actually have too low a view of yourself. You might be struggling with that idea that God would even care for me. I mean, who am I? I'm nothing special. But in this part of the Bible, Jesus says, no, if you believe in Jesus, you are incredibly precious. Because the King identifies with you, God's agents are looking out for you, and God will not let you perish. But remember, other followers of Jesus have that same status. Treat them that way you would expect, no matter how impressive or unimpressive they might be according to the status of their achievements, no matter how big or small they might seem in the world's eyes. But it also gives us a way to think about achievement as well, to think about the things we often think of as making us great. You know, it's not that promotions or a house or a car or any of those things are bad. You know, if we can give thanks for them, they're good things. But actually, Jesus says, don't let them distract you from following him. And if we actually put them under him, well, that actually gives us a great freedom to use them well. We don't need to thoughtlessly pursue them as if that's what all life was about. But if they come along as an opportunity, we can consider, is this actually a good way to serve the King? Well, Jesus' little ones, we've seen, they remember that these things, these achievement things, they're not where true greatness lies. Because Jesus says greatness, real greatness, it's not based on achievement, but it's based on a relationship with him, the King, the one who is truly great.
Verse 10. You believe in angels? What's the story? You said we could ask you at
sure.
the time, so I'm asking.
I believe in angels. It's in the Bible there. So yeah.
What do you think it means there? Does it? What's verse 10 mean?
What's verse 10 mean? So we had a look at verse 10, and so I think the guts of it is that like I said in the talk, God's agents, his messengers are looking out for his little ones. You know, there's a bit of debate about exactly what's going on in the passage there, but the imagery that's used, the way that heaven is sometimes depicted in the Old Testament, it's kind of like a medieval courtroom. So, you know, there's the king, so God, and then some of his courtiers, sort of angels, they'll come and speak to him, and they're in his presence, and so I wonder if part of that is you've actually got representatives, people who are looking out for you, who are in God's presence. The angels are also people who then do some of God's work around the world, and so you've got this sense of they're actually out there looking after his people. I wonder if it's almost a picture of, I couldn't think of a movie that actually had this example, but it's sort of a type scene where, you know, someone maybe goes up to a great person in a bar or a pub, you know, because they want to have words with them. They want to say, I'm not happy with you. And they come up to them and they're all angry. And suddenly, there's about 20 people scattered around the restaurant who stand up because the great one's being threatened. I wonder if it's that sort of an image. You have God's agents, messengers, who are looking out for his little ones. And so actually, he's invested in them. And so no matter how much or how little they've achieved, actually you'll still recognise a certain level. You'll recognise that they are great in God's eyes. And that'll treat how you respect them. And interact with them.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Mr. Joslin.
Great. Okay. Obviously, this sounds pretty serious if you cause Jesus' little ones to stumble.
Mm.
Bad consequences.
Mm.
How do you think people, us, might cause Jesus' disciples to stumble in our context?
In our context?
Put some examples to
you. So, it's one of those lines where you could almost take it and lift it and put it in. You can talk about it generally, sort of any sort of sin. If you're actually causing someone to sin in any sort of sense, then that's a bad thing. Particularly in this thinking about greatness, I wonder if it's encouraging people to chase after other things and achievements rather than looking to Jesus. So possibly in a Christian context, you know, do you expect someone to conform to a certain standard before they're really a follower of Jesus? You know, you're not a real follower of Jesus until you have, you know, your nice short haircut and wear your nice shirt on Sundays. You know, if that was an expectation you're placing on someone, well then actually to be acceptable before God's people and God, you're expecting someone to dress in a certain way. That's sort of an achievement based. But Jesus says, no, it's not about, you know, having a nice haircut or wearing a nice shirt. Actually, it's about the relationship with Him.
People
who are making up false religious rules. And I think I'd also want to push as well, you know, if you're a follower of Jesus, and the way that we often talk and assume in the world around us is if there's an opportunity to advance your career, to kind of achieve more and become greater, we say, well, it's a no-brainer. Of course you do that. You should chase that. But there's always going to be a cost. And so I actually think if you're a follower of Jesus, one of the things that you want to encourage people to do and to think through some of these decisions is, are you actually following Jesus in doing this, or are you chasing worldly greatness? It's not that advancing your career or, you know, getting a new car or a different house is bad, but if that's where you're suddenly chasing after because that's where real greatness lies, then you're starting to shift away from coming before God saying, actually, it's only because I know Jesus, and starting to shift towards, well, I'm great because of my position, of everything I've achieved. And like we saw at the start, that's not the way to be saved. So I wonder if that's something that we'd want to think about, how do we actually go about that sort of thing when we're making decisions and encouraging others to live a certain way.
Okay, we've got time for one more. Yes?
Janie.
So I guess, to a certain degree, we're not meant to chase greatness in the sense that we're all meant to chase greatness.
Mm.
But I think certainly sometimes as a Christian we can be discouraged because the culture is saying you're such a loser if you're not achieving your potential, going to your masters, go get that promotion, stay back long hours.
Yep. So what are things that Christians can, I guess, remember or be doing to actually help remind them of these truths? That actually, because greatness in Jesus' eyes is very different to what the world is, how can you remember it? So one, I think actually these are some of the things Jesus says here is worth reminding yourself of. Actually, you know, when the world says, why aren't you going for your masters? Why aren't you fulfilling your potential? If you're doing something that kind of the world around you goes, why would you do that? Is to keep reminding yourself of why you're doing it and of where true greatness lies. Surrounding yourself with Christian friends who are going to help keep pointing you, or people who point you to Jesus, I think would be another thing. And then actually in the way that Jesus followers relate to each other is to keep reminding themselves of that as well. And so, you know, just because, you know, you haven't got your masters, that doesn't make you any less valuable, and I'm not going to, you know, hold you up on a pedestal because you have achieved so much. I think the way that the community around Jesus keeps relating to each other means they keep looking to Jesus and reminding each other not to be looking at world-based achievement. So I think a mixture of those things.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.